Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This is the Broadcast Journalist Series at the University of St. Thomas. Tonight, featuring Washington Post politics reporter David Farenthold, the winner of the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. I'm Mike Edgerly from NPR News. David Farenthold has reported at the Washington Post since 2000. Besides presidential politics, he's reported on Congress, the federal bureaucracy, the environment, and D.C. police. You've also seen him on CNN, and he's now at MSNBC. David, welcome to St. Paul, and thank you for joining us in the Broadcast Journalist Series.
Well, thank you for having me.
You broke a story about the president's charitable giving. Talk to me a little bit about how that series of reports came about, where you and the Post examined Donald Trump's claims to be a generous giver from his foundation and otherwise.
Well, it started out about as randomly as you could possibly imagine. Not on purpose at all. We didn't set out to cover Trump's charitable giving. In fact, I was a politics reporter, so I'd spent a lot of 2015 and the beginning part of 2016 writing sort of one-off candidate profiles. There's a story about Hillary Clinton's ideas. Here's a story about Bernie Sanders' time in Vermont. Here, you know, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio. And so I really took an interest in loser candidates that had no shot of winning. The problem was that having chosen loser candidates meant that a lot of them were kaput even before the voting began. Like Rick Perry, I went to go cover Rick Perry's 2016 campaign. He actually dropped out in the middle of the speech that I wanted to see him give. So that's a long way of saying we got to caucus day in Iowa 2016, all my candidates I knew anything about were already gone. And so they said, well, go to Iowa and follow Donald Trump around for a day. You know, on caucus day, there was this crazy idea, it seemed crazy at the time, that Donald Trump, this guy had been married 3 times, he'd been on the cover of Playboy twice, that he was going to win this famously socially Christian conservative state. So I went to Iowa and I saw Trump give one of several events. This one was in Waterloo, Iowa. And in the middle of this campaign rally, he does something odd. He pulls out this giant check, like a golf tournament size check, for $100,000. And it's from the Donald J. Trump Foundation. And he brings up this local veterans charity, and he brings them up on the stage, and he says, okay, you know, you do great work. I'm going to give you this donation. They say thank you. They sit down, and the rally begins again. I thought, well, that was odd. I've never seen anyone give away a charitable donation in the middle of a presidential rally. And the reason is basically because that kind of thing is illegal. You can't use your charity to boost your presidential campaign. So that got us interested in this money that Trump had given to charity. Where did it come from? How did he have $100,000 to give to this veterans charity in this politically important state? And it led us to this fundraiser that Trump had. He'd once backed out of a Fox News debate in Iowa and had his own sort of fundraiser or telethon to counter-program the Fox News debate, in which he said he raised $6 million for veterans. And this $100,000 had come out of that $6 million. So the question I started with was what I thought was a couple days story. Where did the rest of the money go? You know, what I assumed that he had given the money away if he said he was, but what charities did he choose? You know, what can those choices tell us about what he thinks of veterans, which is this really important part of his campaign? And I thought that would be a story that would take me 2 or 3 days, and I'd be on to something else. And it turned out they wouldn't answer the question, and so it became something that consumed. That grew and grew and grew and consumed the rest of my year.
So when the Trump Organization did not answer the question, what did you think?
I was surprised, honestly. I mean, I was used to dealing with the Clinton campaign, who, you know, they would call and harangue you and tell you you're stupid and, you know, your questions were bad. But they would eventually give you answers. And Trump's people just never got back to me, never answered the question. And so I just kept after it while doing other things for months. And it wasn't until the end of May, so this started in February 1st, 2016. It wasn't until the end of May that I actually got a little bit of an answer. And that answer was, so out of the $6 million that Trump had raised, he said $1 million had come out of his own pocket. And I couldn't find anybody who'd gotten even a dollar of the million that was supposed to be Trump's own money. And so Corey Lewandowski, Trump's campaign manager at the time, called me in May and said, okay, I can tell you now for sure, you've been asking questions about this, Donald Trump has given away the $1 million that he pledged to charity. And I said, well, you know, who did he give it to? He said, well, I can't tell you who he gave it to or when or in what amount. It's all secret. But just trust me, Donald Trump has given his $1 million away. So then we set out to sort of check that assertion. We talked about the sort of trying to be transparent. Mm-hmm. It was basically began as kind of an act of reporting desperation that Corey Lewandowski told me this thing that I had no reason to disbelieve, but I wanted to check. And so I started using social media to try to find anybody who might have been one of these mystery recipients, might have gotten some of this $1 million.
And so what you did was go on Twitter, and you actually showed the list of the intended charities, and you were checking them off. Is that right? Tell us about that.
Well, so it began with just asking people, have you gotten any of this money? You know, veterans charities, have you seen even a dollar of this money? And nobody, I heard back from a lot of charities who said, you know, thanks for calling or thanks for reaching out to us, but no, I couldn't find any of the money. It turned out because Trump hadn't actually given it away. Only after I had made sort of a big stink about it on Twitter that night, later on, then Trump gave the $1 million away. And so we said, wow, you know, he tried to weasel out of a commitment to veterans, or it seems like he tried to weasel out of a commitment to veterans, for $1 million under the microscope of a presidential campaign. So let's go back and say, you know, before this, when he was just a rich guy in New York, when Entertainment Tonight was the only journalist covering him, had he ever done this before? Had he ever promised to give money to some worthy cause and then not followed through? And so that became a much longer look at his charitable promises over his lifetime or over his career. And that's when I started. The Trump people wouldn't tell me. I said, well, who did Donald Trump give? You know, he said it turned out he'd been saying all these years, I'd give away lots and lots of money, millions of dollars. And when I asked the Trump campaign, well, who did he give it to? They wouldn't tell me. So then I tried to find people, tried to prove Trump right by finding people who he might have given money to. So I started calling all the charities that I thought were most likely to have gotten a gift from him, charities he tweeted about, charities that had events in Mar-a-Lago, anybody that seemed like they had a connection to Trump, and asking them, hey, have you ever gotten a donation out of Trump's own pocket? And then keeping a running list of that.
Right. You wrote at the time, as a part of that reporting, Trump's campaign has a tendency to focus on front-end spectacle over back-end details. Has that analysis changed since that line of reporting?
I mean, I should say that's true of a lot of us.
Of course. But, guilty.
But in the specific arena of charity, once our charity reporting began and sort of started to get attention, Trump actually got better about delivering. He promised a few times during the campaign to give money to flood victims in Louisiana, and he actually followed through. As president, he has promised to give away his presidential salary, and it seems like so far he has. There's some patterns about Trump's personality, about the way he approaches sort of the question of follow through. I felt like I had these sort of what seemed like novel insights at the time that he doesn't really plan ahead. He just reacts to what's in the moment. He doesn't take all things he promises today. He doesn't necessarily think he has to comply with tomorrow. We obviously have seen the results of that. You know, that's been our national obsession for the last year and a half. But I feel like I sort of was one of the people to see it first.
Right. So you're saying his intentions were good. They were spontaneous, and the follow-up was not so rigorous. How would you analyze that?
It's hard to get in his mind and talk about his intentions, but it seems like he recognized that to be a rich guy, sort of a playboy, Bruce Wayne sort of figure in New York at that time, that people expected that part of playing that archetype was that you would be sort of, you could be profligate and you could be seen out with models and you could spend wildly on yourself, but there was an expectation that kind of guy would also spontaneously give money away in these sort of grand gestures. And so he knew, I think he understood that was part of the role he was playing. And sometimes he would promise that kind of money and then give it. Like he paid for a big Veterans Day parade in New York in the 90s. But sometimes he would promise that money and not do it. Mm. And sometimes he would just sort of take on the appearance of charity and not actually follow through with the substance at all. One of the most amazing stories we learned about this entire process was in the 90s, there was an orphanage for children whose parents had died of AIDS in New York. And they were having a grand opening. And the media is there. The Mayor Giuliani's there. Mayor Dinkins, who'd been the past mayor. Kathy Lee Gifford, all these people who'd given to it, right? And they're saving a seat on stage for a guy who was like a sort of a less, you know, a very prominent New York developer, not as famous as Trump. He'd given a lot of money to build this orphanage. And they're saving a seat for him. It's like 5 minutes until the thing starts. Trump has never given a dime to this organization. He has no connection to them at all. Suddenly Donald Trump walks in and he takes the seat on stage meant for the guy who'd actually given all the money. And everyone else on stage is sort of frozen. They don't know what to do. Like, they had no idea Donald Trump was coming. They've never had any connection with him. And they're like, what do we do? But it's too late. The music is starting. And so they have this whole ceremony where they sing This Little Light of Mine. They dance the Macarena with the orphans. Trump doesn't have to speak, but everybody on stage is thinking, like, well, this is so weird. But it must be that Donald Trump is here to surprise us with a really big gift. You know, no one would just take a seat on stage and claim this implicit credit for being a friend of orphans and not give money in an impressive way. So his gift will be twice as good because there's been this sort of like lead up to it. The ceremony ends and Trump leaves and never gives a dime. Not only does he not give any money, he causes damage to their relationship with the developer whose seat Trump stole and didn't get the credit he deserved. That, to me, I couldn't believe that story when I first heard it, but there are pictures of it. To me, encapsulated Trump's view of charity, which was if you could get the credit, if you know you could abuse sort of an honor system, that people would say, well, there's no way somebody would do that unless they had put in the work behind the scenes. If he could exploit that, he would.
Right. What was the response from Donald Trump and the campaign at that point?
In general, they did not respond at all to my questions. Trump once called me a nasty guy early on.
Right. But when I asked about reaction, I was wondering about the personal reaction directed at you.
I only talked to him once during this coverage, which was I mentioned that Corey Lewandowski had told me he'd given away $1 million, and we later learned that he hadn't. We learned that he hadn't because, you know, 2 days or 3 days after Lewandowski had said, the money's out the door, Donald Trump's given this money away, Trump called me after I'd kind of made a stink on Twitter to say, okay, now I'm giving the money away. Yeah, he gave it all this, it's kind of funny in retrospect, he gave it all $1 million in one fell swoop to a charity for retired FBI agents and their children. It was run by a friend of his who was a former FBI agent. So Trump said, he said, I've given away all $1 million. And I said, why did it take you so long? You promised this money, you know, months ago. Corey told me you'd given away, past tense, 4 days ago. Why are you only giving it out now? And he said, well, I had to vet the group. I had to vet to make sure they were worthy. And it just happened that I knew from previous reporting, this group had given him like its Man of the Year award and a big ceremony at the Waldorf Astoria like 2 years before, or a year before, I think. There'd been a whole dinner in black tie where the whole purpose of the dinner was to say how much this group loved Donald Trump. I said, after that, you had to vet them? And he said, well, that's true. And I said, did you just give this money away now because I was asking about it? You know, if I hadn't made us think about this, would you have ever given it away? And that's when he called me a nasty guy.
Is that a quote, nasty
yeah,
guy?
Yeah, you're a nasty guy. It was a weird interview because he would say, like, you're a nasty guy. You should be so ashamed of yourself. But then, like, I'm not there to argue with him about whether I'm a nasty person or not. But there were some factual questions that I needed him to answer about other people's money that he was still hanging on to. And so I would say, like, okay, fine. You know, what about this other money? I would sort of try to reset it to something factual. And he would sort of stop the insults, reset, and answer my question factually, or at least address the premise of that question. And then that answer would devolve into insults. But, you know, you're so nasty. You're such a terrible person. And then ask him another factual question. He would reset again. It was like his heart wasn't in it, but he knew he sort of had to insult me. That's the last time I've spoken to him, actually.
Wow. That's really unusual, isn't it?
I've dealt with hostility from plenty of people in the Obama administration, plenty of people in the Clinton campaign, plenty of people in general. I've never had an interview quite like that.
Right. You're still reporting on the finances of Donald Trump and his organization. Can you take us inside how you do that? How did that begin for you? You'd worked your way on reporting through the charities and so forth. Then when did you turn to a little broader look at him?
Basically after the election. So Trump's charity, the Donald J. Trump Foundation, which was this odd foundation funded mostly by Vince McMahon, the wrestling guy, that after our reporting, it basically shut down. It's still under investigation by the New York Attorney General because it seems to have violated the law. In fact, they've admitted violating the law in the way that they operated. But the charity story was over. He was not giving away money anymore. So I was trying to find a way to apply that kind of expertise. You know, I felt like I had some insights into his character and the way he dealt with money. And so that instead of going to cover the EPA or to go to cover some other agency, I should go cover the Trump Organization, his business, it's been fascinating. So I'd never covered business before. And also, this is a really, really odd business. It's very, very private. It tells you almost nothing about its operations. And it's also involved in a whole bunch of, it has like a toe into all these different fields. It's not a dominant player in any of them. And it's not a big enough player in any field for other people in that field to really know much about it. And also the facts about it are, or like the documents about it are scattered in all these different places. So this last year has been sort of trying to find all the different places, you know, event permits in Bedminster, New Jersey, tax assessment appeals in Los Angeles County, all the places where, for various reasons, the Trump Organization has to give up a little bit of itself and to try to understand it from, you know, by piecing all those together.
You wrote a piece April 13th about the collection of branded Trump articles, items that exist or maybe no longer exist. Was there really a Trump-branded urine test?
Yes, there was a Trump-branded urine test. The way in 2010, Trump, his merchandising empire, which had begun with suits and ties, had expanded to all kinds of crazy directions. Vodka, K-cup coffee pods, mattresses. And he got involved in this thing called the Trump Network, which was a vitamin company. So it was like a multi-level marketing scheme. And the idea was that he would send you a Trump-branded urine test for $130. It had a big Trump logo on it. And you would provide a sample and send it back. And then Donald Trump's laboratory would analyze it and send you...
Donald Trump has a laboratory?
Yeah, the Trump laboratory. All of this is like, can you imagine being like, you know, who would really be able to analyze my urine well? The guy from The Apprentice. He looks like somebody who really knows about the body's metabolic processes. And so that was the idea, was that they would analyze your urine and then they would send you back Trump, you know, vitamins that were tailored to your metabolic needs. That did not last very long. It died out long before he ran for president, in part because people raised questions about whether right. the vitamins did any good. But just talking about the weird business that it's in, like, I never thought when I became a politics reporter that I would ever need to understand the perfume industry or the like the merchandising industry. But because the Trump brand was in that, I now know a lot about the perfume industry. So if we ever have President Mike Pence, the knowledge that I have is almost going to be completely useless. It'll never be useful again in politics.
Right. Talk a little bit about how you penetrated the Trump Organization to find out about these things. You were talking about, you know, the permits in Los Angeles and filings in New Jersey. How did you draw all of that out? How did you find that stuff?
Sort of by trial and error. You know, there's the places where you find Trump, the documents that tell you something about the Trump Organization are in these really obscure, at least obscure to me, processes. Thank God for overregulation in the Northeast, because one of the things we're trying to figure out was, are people that hold golf tournaments and galas and other things at Trump's clubs in Mar-a-Lago, are they leaving because they don't want to be tainted by the Trump brand? Are they coming in because they want to buy influence or because they support Trump? What's happening with that business? And of course, the Trump Organization will tell you almost nothing about it. But thank God, places like New Jersey and Palm Beach, Florida regulate the heck out of these things. So if you're going to have a party a gala in Palm Beach, Florida, you need to file all this paperwork with the town saying how many people you expect, how much you expect to pay. So learning that, but that bureaucratic scheme is different in every county and every town. And to learn those different things and those different regulatory schemes, you can put in a Freedom of Information Act request and get back a little bit of detail about who's doing business with Trump and how that's changing. But I didn't know any of these worlds before. And so to learn every little town where he has a golf course or where he has a hotel, I'm still doing that. We've been doing a lot of things lately with deed records. You know, who does he owe money to? What mortgage does he have? Another like arcane world that we've had to learn and master. But there's stuff there if you know how to do it.
So what is your day like doing this kind of research? I mean, it sounds like you're searching for something that you may not even know exists.
Yes. So what we try to do is to have sort of two or three things going on at any one time, because some of these things take a long time to work on. So the story about merchandising, I had a couple of interns from American University who I gave the unglamorous job of calling all the people who used to make Trump-branded things, Trump-branded ties or mattresses or whatever, and asking them, do you still make it, or have you stopped since Trump got into the presidential election? A surprisingly difficult task. People just did not want to admit that they'd ever made Trump-branded successory signs or Trump-bit, which is a real example. We had to send somebody, a reporter in person to an office outside Los Angeles to get somebody to admit that, yes, once they made Donald J. Trump inspirational posters and now they no longer do. But also, one of the things we've tried to take advantage to try to keep track, there's some places where we're trying to every day or every week keep track of what's going on. Who is doing business with the president? And the two of the big examples are Mar-a-Lago and the Trump Hotel in D.C. two places where the president often goes. And so even as business has been lost elsewhere, people that want to influence the president, foreign countries, activist groups, they know that if you go to the Trump Hotel or you go to Mar-a-Lago, there's a chance you might see him in person and get to put your idea in his ear. So that's monitoring that has been monitoring Instagram. Instagram has been a huge resource for that because people geotag their Instagram postings, their pictures, for these Trump clubs. So I did it today, actually. You know, every week I spend a couple of hours going through every wedding photo that happens at all these different clubs, every photo of anything, a lot of pictures of people giving their middle finger to various Trump properties, just to find out who's having their events there. A lot of sending out Freedom of Information Act requests. The trouble for me is I've got all these spreadsheets going of tracking all these Trump businesses, you know, day to day. The trouble for me is like I could spend all day filling out the spreadsheets. How do I pull myself back and, you know, see a big picture and write that story? You know, and so that's been the balance.
How do you find the story in something like that? For people who don't work in news, it sounds like a nightmare of facts and spreadsheets. But you're looking for something that tells us we don't know,
yeah.
Right? How do you bring those threads together to make something really worth reading and is interesting?
To me, sometimes a trend really strikes you. You know, you'll notice something and it's very obvious. One example of that would be this. We had a story last year where I was in a Trump golf club and spotted this fake Time magazine cover, or what we later learned was a fake Time magazine cover with him on the cover. Someone had made a Time magazine cover that didn't exist, showing Trump on the, you know, on the front. And so once when we spotted that, you say, okay, he put up a fake Time magazine cover of himself. That's a story. I gotta find out more about that. But a lot of times when you're seeing trends among that are more long-term trends among his customers, the success of his businesses, I find it's really helpful to have a dialogue with my editors and with the other reporters who work with me. We're always sort of talking about what we find. And there are times when I'm so far down the rabbit hole that something doesn't surprise me. And then when you mention it to somebody else, they go, wow, that's really surprising. Or there's times when, because I'm new to the business of commercial real estate, I think something's really surprising and it's actually not. That's the important thing for me, is never to get so engrossed in it that I'm not talking about it and sort of hearing myself talk myself into story ideas, but also getting other people who are less far down the rabbit hole to say that's interesting or no, that's not.
Do you get information leaked from the White House or the administration itself? You don't have to answer that.
Others at the Post get a lot of information leaked from the White House. I don't really seek it, and I don't think the White House knows that much. At least I have not found anybody. No, I don't mean they don't know that much about anything. I don't think they know that much about the operation of Trump golf clubs or hotels. I do not get it. What I get is from public sources so far. I would love to have more inside sources, but it's mostly from public documents now.
Right. I'd like to broaden the discussion just a little bit here to talk about your journalism and how it compares to what is a proliferation, it's beyond proliferation, of punditry, basically, and opinion, and argument, whereas you deal in facts. How do you fit into that universe?
Well, I try to think about what I, as a consumer of news, like and care about, and which is I value, obviously, breaking news, but I value expertise. So I think when people say punditry, that often encompasses two very different things, right? There are people that, when I want to know what's happening with the North Korean missile program, there's people this is actually one of the few things Twitter is useful for. There's people that I follow who know a lot about missiles and nuclear weapons programs. I want that kind of expertise. I want to know what's really going on. But that's about, 5% of the opinion, the opinions had publicly, or, people who are paid to have opinions are that kind of person. I try to avoid people who comment on everything and don't really know much about anything, especially which is a lot of punditry, people who chose a side in this tribal, politics of ours 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and so everything they see, they filter. Their goal is to take that issue and find out why their side is right. I don't find that very interesting as a reader, and I think there's often too much of it, especially in television, presented as journalism, where there's not a real rigor put into finding out whether the people who you have to opine on television really know that much about the topic. We were talking backstage about this. One of the real frustrations for me when I was in 2016, when I would go on television, they'd have me on and I'd say, they'd say, well, tell us about your latest story. And I'd talk about the Trump charity. And a lot of it was not super complicated, but there were times when you were talking about, you know, whether they'd violated a particular New York state law or a particular part of the IRS code. The details mattered. I mean, in some cases, it mattered in a legal sense. And I had worked really hard to get it exactly right. And so they have me on, I talk about what I reported. And then they end my segment and they go to the panel of pundits or experts or whatever they call them, reacting to what I just said. And so I can't, I'm not on television anymore, but I still have my little earpiece in. I can hear the next panel beginning. And sometimes literally the first word to come out of the mouth of one of the panel of experts was wrong, like wrong on the facts, not wrong on the opinion, wrong on the facts. And so they're now having a debate about something that's not even true or about a law that doesn't exist. There's not enough rigor. Those people like that are allowed to sort of opine without really a lot of attention to whether they have their facts right. And I think this is a time when things are changing rapidly and the facts matter. I think we're ill-served by people like that.
And how does President Trump fit into that?
Well, he is a hard president to cover, and it was especially hard. I don't write about the White House that often, so I'm sort of thinking about this from afar. But there was an assumption built on past White Houses, Bush, Obama, going back further, that if the president said something, the president just didn't sort of toss off opinions about whatever. If the president said something, it meant the president was going to do something about it. And there was a whole, if the president spoke about a topic, there was a whole phalanx of other people who were preparing talking points and executive orders. There was going to be a push behind whatever the president said. And so that was reflected in the weeks of the coverage right after the election. Whenever Trump tweeted anything, I'm going to send the feds into Chicago, 3 million people voted illegally. There was this whole apparatus that had been built for covering past presidents' utterances who were like, we did breaking news alerts. We wrote stories. What's he going to do about sending the feds into Chicago? What's he going to do about the 3 million people voting illegally? With the understanding that if the president spoke about it, the president was going to do something about it. And obviously with this president, those things are completely disconnected. There are sometimes when he talks about something and does something about it. More often he talks about something and does nothing about it. And I think we had to sort of learn to get used to this idea that the president is just sort of yelling at the television through Twitter and with us all watching. And that's been one of the challenges of covering his administration is, I think, to try to understand what if his utterances are really useful in a policy context, and then what if it is just noise that he has forgotten about long before we forget about it.
I'd like to get your reaction to the White House Correspondents' Dinner over the weekend, specifically the remarks by Michelle Wolf, who addressed the news media. She was the comedian who spoke, the main performer. She wrote, in addressing the news media, he has helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you are profiting from him. What did you make of that?
First, I wasn't invited to the dinner, so I only read about it later.
But you did take part in the pre and the after party.
I went to the pre-party with open bar and the post-party with open bar, and in the middle, I went out to dinner, and that worked out really well. So she is right on part of that. The Trump phenomenon has been incredibly profitable for a number of news outlets. It has brought so much more attention to us and to TV networks, and that's obvious. I think for the right reasons. I think people have recognized how much could change in their lives, and that this idea that Washington was sort of boring and far away and not that important has changed, and they want to know what's happening there. That's why they're coming to us. I don't think we created him. You know, maybe in some way television created him in some way. I don't think I had anything to do with creating the presidency of Donald Trump. The broader point, I guess, of there's been a lot of unhappy reaction to her comedy routine. And I think it's just a reflection of how much Washington has changed. That whole ritual was built for a time when the disagreements in Washington between the two sides were small, when the like disagreements about the role of the press in society between those in power and those covering it were small. You know, in some way, everybody sort of felt like they were the same team. They were all in the same, not the same team exactly, but they were all playing by the same rules, and they all understood their parts, and the stakes of it were relatively low for everybody. So it seems fine to have, the president come on, give a little speech poking fun at the media, and then someone gives a speech poking fun at the president. Everyone goes to the pre and the post parties and has a good time. It reflected an era, I think, in which there's a lot of what we do in journalism, not just this dinner, the sort of winners and losers coverage of campaigns. Like all of this was built for a world in which the actual policymaking of Washington seemed very not dramatic or not interesting. And so you had to look for other ways to make it interesting, and the stakes seemed so low. That's not the era we're in now, right? I think we all recognize that the administration's attacks on the credibility of the media are something unlike we've seen coming out of the White House before. I just think that the two sides in Washington, the Republicans and Democrats, are further apart and more at permanent odds than they were before. And so now Trump, recognizing this change, doesn't show up anymore. But so now we have, instead of kind of like a good-natured give and take between the two sides, we have nobody from his side, and this very sort of profane, caustic comedian from the, you know, representing, I guess, the media. And then people think that she's sort of speaking for us. And her routine was funny, and it would have been great in some other venue, in a, you know, comedy club in Washington or New York. I don't want people to think that you know, you can't tell the truth about the president, and you can't make fun of the president, and you can't be caustic about the president. Obviously, that's something that happens in our society and should happen. But to have it at an event, to have it be the main thing that happens at a dinner that ostensibly celebrates journalism, I think is a weird mismatch. And I don't know whether, you know, they should shrink it. If Trump's still going to continue not to show up, I don't know if they should start having some tamer comedians. They should start having, like Jimmy Kimmel suggested, jugglers. Like, I don't think that format, half of that format works. So I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be like next year, but this year seems like it sort of exposed it as maybe unsustainable.
And you said earlier the Post will not be sending anyone to the dinner.
Well, the Times, the New York Times does not go. We go. We have gone. This is obviously not my choice. But I wonder if it continues in this way. I wonder if we will decide not to go next year. Right. Maybe it'll change. There was a very nice Post pre-party, and I would hate to have that go away. Again, just showing up and leaving. If we just do a pre-party, that's fine. Nobody goes to the actual dinner. That'd be fine with me. The biggest lobbyist against that would be Men's Warehouse, because they send,
because of the rentals,
they rent tuxes to 1,000 people that day.
I found a quote, David, that you had given to the Milwaukee paper, I think about a year ago. You said of Trump's relationship with the media, quote, "We're like his most important constituency, but on the other hand, he wants people to hate us. It's a strange mixture. The thing that's the most deliberate strategy to me is to have everything be kind of a tornado of news, constant tumult and drama." I think you hit that tornado part pretty well.
That's one thing that's really different about this era. And I have to say it's slowed down a little bit in the post-Steve Bannon era. I think that Trump's world in some ways has shrunk a bit, so that instead of, at least for the last couple of months, making decisions that affect, you know, immigration or something, or healthcare or something more broad, his world has kind of shrunk to his own legal fights, you know, which he could still cause a lot of news. But particularly last year, there was this sense that if you imagine when I sat down and imagined my reader, you know, it was not the person that I imagined even a few years before, which, you know, used to, I would imagine my reader as somebody who comes into work, you know, or they're looking at their paper or their phone at their breakfast table, they come into work, they got a cup of coffee, and I have their undivided attention, and they, if I write something, they might remember, and it's in a string of other stories, you could count on them to remember what those things were and to understand why whatever this was like to recognize this, your story today, as part of an ongoing series of stories and to understand why it was important. You can't take that for granted at all now. I mean, I forget things that happened yesterday. Right. Everyone does. And so that's the tornado. You have to think about giving your readers, both within the story you write and also within social media and other ways, like a thread to follow, a way to sort of hold on to your story day to day and not lose track of it. And if you do lose track of it, a way to recapture it.
You're listening to the Broadcast Journalist Series at the University of St. Thomas, featuring Washington Post politics reporter David Farenthold, the winner of the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. David, I'd like to ask you about Twitter. You've used it effectively in your earlier reporting as you described the information gathering you did. Where do you think Donald Trump would be without that particular social medium?
That's a great point. He'd be in a very different place. I mean, he had platforms. He could go on. He went on Fox and Friends. He spoke at CPAC. But, Twitter is like the bloodstream of Washington journalism, or political journalism particularly. And his ability to use that to get on television, to get, ideas in the bloodstream of Washington journalism, I think he, you know, it's hard to say counterfactually, but it seems like it would be hard for him to have gotten, you know, as far as he did and as cheaply as he did in the before he ran for president without Twitter.
I'd like to ask you about the book by James Comey, the former FBI director. What was your reaction to that? It revealed some interesting details about his time with the administration, but he came kind of hard at Donald Trump in a way. He sort of embraced sort of Donald Trump's approach to relationships.
Right.
Picking on his hair and referring to his ties.
Yeah, his tan lines or things like that. It taught me that I know nothing about the book publishing industry. When I heard that James Comey had written a book, I thought he's given 1,000 interviews about these same instances.
What's left to say?
Who would? But it's the book has been it's sold incredibly well. To me, Trump's genius or his, I don't know if he even knows how he does it, but the thing he's been able to do in politics is to. He doesn't have a plan often. He has sort of a gut-level reaction. He knows what he's going to do today or, you know, 5 minutes from now. But he managed to get other people to quit following their plan and to just, you know, not fall to his level, but to Trump becomes the star around which they orbit. Think of all the people, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, eventually Hillary Clinton, who came into this campaign saying, I'm going to talk about this and this and this. I have a 10-point plan for that. I'm going to whatever Jeb's thing was. We have the right to rise. And then they threw it all out the window and just talked about Donald Trump and just let, you know, they made their campaigns about how Donald Trump was a bad person or unfit person or uncouth person. And there was nothing about the campaign that Trump himself didn't dominate. He was the sun they all orbited around. And often that meant taking on his characteristics, his sort of approach to, you know, all the norms he overstepped and the way he talked about other people. Comey's credibility in this context comes from the fact that he represents an entirely different culture, right? He represents the FBI culture of facts and, you know, the sort of, you know, dry but reliable and non-partisan, you know, somebody who follows the facts where they lead and doesn't jump to conclusions, right? That's what movies tell us FBI agents are like. So that's the power Comey had. And he did in the beginning was say, you know, look, I'm not somebody who's in this for politics. I just want to do my job. But I could not help but be affected by the way Trump was acting. You know, the memos that Comey wrote, he was so shocked at the way Trump was trying to politicize the FBI. For Comey, you give that power away if you are seen as becoming a partisan actor or if you're seen as somebody who will comment on anything that goes by. You know, if you're somebody who just sort of gets into the political fray or starts borrowing Trumpian tactics, talking about the, you know, tan lines under his eyes or his fingers or things like that, you lose the power that you had. And we've seen so many people give that power, give their own credibility away by thinking, well, if Trump can do it, I can too. You have to fight fire with fire, and you lose the ideals that you're supposedly defending, and you lose your power, which came from you not being Trump.
Did he dilute his power, do you think, his authority?
I mean, I think he has. I mean, he certainly made a big impression. Maybe it was better than, maybe the way he did it was most effective. But to me, the more he is seen as like a political figure or that he's doing this out of, you know, retribution against Trump or something like that, that he's not following, you know, not just following the facts, I think he dilutes his power.
What did you make of the raid on President Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen's office? What did that say to you?
It's a very significant legal step. One of the really interesting things about covering the Trump presidency is the degree to which other, you know, that you see that how the different parts of the federal government sometimes move without, you know, word from the center. That investigation into Michael Cohen, well, we were all focusing on the Mueller investigation. This Michael Cohen investigation had gone on for months, apparently, and it was apparently quite advanced. I think it's a very concerning development for Cohen that they got so many documents, and potentially for Trump. I mean, we've seen already the role that Cohen seems to have played in the last days of the campaign, which was sort of arranging apparently for hush money to be paid to Stormy Daniels. If he had played that role for Trump in other parts of his life, it's sort of hard to believe he would have started 2 weeks before the presidential election. And we may learn more about the way Trump operated, you know, as a businessman.
Right. What are you working on now?
I'm waiting for the editors who are taking their sweet time on a particular story. I'm interested in the sort of financial architecture of the Trump organization. It owes a lot of money to a lot of people, some of whom we don't really understand. It owns a lot of properties in ways that don't seem to make a lot of sense from a business perspective. For instance, and this has been talked about a little bit in the context of the Russia investigation, he owns these golf clubs in Scotland and Ireland. So Trump owns a bunch of golf clubs, but for a long time he followed kind of a prudent strategy toward buying golf clubs, which is he'd wait for a golf club in suburban Philly or something like that to get into financial trouble or to go into bankruptcy. Or there's one in LA where the 18th green slid off into the ocean. He'd find people, find golf clubs that were sort of in a financially vulnerable time, buy them, and then sort of put the Trump veneer on them, even though they were way out from, you know, he'd call it Trump Philadelphia, even though it's like half, you know, halfway into New Jersey. You know, Trump Washington, D.C. is like three counties away from Washington, D.C. He would sort of put the Trump marketing sheen on it and make, you know, he'd gotten it so cheap that he couldn't help but succeed. In 2012, he throws that sensible golf course buying playbook out the window and starts blowing money on prestige properties, places that have held golf tournaments in the past, famous golf tournaments, but also have lose money at prodigious rates. So the Doral golf course outside Miami, one in Scotland, the Turnberry golf course, and one in Ireland, the Doonbeg golf course. Big. These are not just golf courses; they're resorts. They are, you know, huge plots of land, and they lose tons of money. You can tell from the Scottish and Irish ones, particularly. He's had to loan those courses like $111 million over the last few years. So he went from sort of counting his pennies and buying only at times of weakness and cheapness to just blowing money on prestige properties that are continuing to lose money. Well, why? You know, what caused him to do that? Why did he do it? How can he sustain it? That's a part of the Trump organization that, you know, if the president's losing money, if the president's golf courses, prestige golf courses, are losing tons of money and he might need somebody's help to hold on to them, mm-hmm. how much would the president owe to that person? Right. So we have to be on the lookout for that kind of thing happening in the future.
Right. Any evidence that Donald Trump or his family are making money off his presidency?
Well, it's hard for me to tell the overall cash flow of the Trump organization. Certainly he's lost business. A bunch of charities stopped having their galas at Mar-a-Lago after the Charlottesville protests last year when Trump said there were, you know, very fine people among the white supremacists. But other places have lost golf tournaments, and, you know, three hotels have taken his name off since the owners have basically kicked out the Trump organization because people wouldn't come to their Trump hotel. But there are places like Mar-a-Lago and the D.C. hotel where he's raking in money, sometimes from people who want specifically to, they say, I'm going to move my gala. I'm going to have a gala at Mar-a-Lago and spend $200,000, $300,000 in one night because I like Donald Trump and I want to put money in his pocket, right? You know, we're used to the idea that if you like the president, you think the president's doing a good job, you might have a fundraiser for him and put money in his campaign's pocket. But the idea that you would just, you know, I like him, I like his policy toward Israel or something like that, I'm going to give him cash money in his pocket. He has the ability to do that, and people are taking advantage of it. So, you know, I don't know what the net of that is, the losses versus the gains, but there are certainly places where he's making money off people who are his political supporters.
Do you think it's good business for him to run for re-election, based on what you've seen of his holdings and his profits and so forth?
Well, when I think about, I mean, there's a lot of calculations that go into that. When I think about that, though, there are things, being president, and has given him new revenue streams that in some cases have and new sources of money that in some cases have compensated for what he's lost, right? If he drops out tomorrow, you know, a lot of these charities that left his clubs because of his comments about Muslims or Hispanics or something else, they're not going to come back. That business is probably lost for a long time. But he has gained business from the RNC, the Republican National Committee, is having lots of events, and it seems like the pace is going up. They're having lots of events at his Trump Hotel, at Doral. They just spent like $200,000 last month at Doral. And also the Trump camp, his own 2020 campaign is paying a lot of legal bills for him and his aides. They're paying Michael Cohen's legal bills. So if he stops running for president and stops being the head of his campaign and the head of the RNC and stops having a reason to collect that political money that then becomes personal money or money spent on things that help him personally, if he ever turns that off, what does he do? So people say, well, he won't run for re-election. I don't know how he replaces that revenue stream if he needs it. I don't know how he replaces it if he stops running.
So it's actually possible there is some financial benefit to him running and being in the White House again.
There's definitely a financial benefit to him running again. I don't know whether in the end being in the White House would be a benefit or not, but the money he gets from the RNC and from his campaign, which would probably dry up if he said he wasn't running for president, that's a lot of money, and I think he would be loath to give that up.
Right. Do you often know more than you're able to report?
That's a good question. I suspect a lot of things that I'm not able to report. There's not a lot of things that I know absolutely for sure and can't at this point prove. I try to be, since I'm in wading in the waters of a business that I don't know, you know, that is very private and the world of business reporting, which is not where I come from, I'm not often very confident that I know what's going on. In fact, sometimes when I find out from the facts that I knew what was going on, I surprise myself.
Right. Has the Post ever had someone devoted full time to the financial affairs of a president or of a candidate in the way that you are?
No. I mean, we've never had a president like this before. I mean, you can see that even in the financial disclosures that presidents file, and they're set up for politicians, basically people who have career politicians and might have a consulting gig on the side, or maybe they wrote a book. I mean, there's no, you know, the loans, the way they report revenue, it's not set up for a guy who's running his whole business through himself personally. So there's never been somebody like this. I mean, and they made Jimmy Carter sell his peanut farm, for goodness sake. So the presidents that have come in with some sort of financial interest have generally tended to get rid of it, even if it's small, because they're afraid of the appearance of conflicts of interest or of violating the emoluments clause. Right. So there's never really been a need like this.
Let me take you back to journalism again. What do you think the future of American journalism is now, given the previous 2 years and the still decline of newspapers, perhaps not the Washington Post or the failing New York Times? But what is the future bright? Is it solid? If not as a business, but as a part of the Constitution?
Well, I mean, certainly the audience is there. I mean, the demand for what we do and what the New York Times does and a lot of other people do is, you know, much greater than it was a couple of years ago. And it's, truthfully, the demand was never the problem. The problem was the cost model, you know, the ability to get people to pay for it. And so in some cases, the Trump era has caused people, the attacks on our credibility have caused people to see us as, like, not just like, you know, the air you breathe, but actually something that needs to be paid for and supported for, you know, or else it could go away. So I'm optimistic about the Washington Post, but we are owned by the richest man in the world, so it's hard to be not optimistic about that. The things that worry me and continue to worry me are places, you know, are the places in, you know, the newspapers in, you know, mid-sized cities, even, you know, bigger cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul. The Strib is doing really well, but the Pioneer Press is not doing that great. There's been a lot of coverage of these hedge funds that are just like stripping capital out of places like the Denver Post and other places that where there is a demand and people want to read the paper, but they're owned by owners who just want to suck the money out and spend it on other things. So I am worried that we have not found the next revenue model, right? For a long time, the business was, you know, have one rich guy in your town own the paper. And those people all own sports teams now. In fact, I've suggested that we start making Pulitzer rings or belt buckles or hats or something we can give to the rich guys who own the papers if they win, you know, the way that you get a Super Bowl ring if your team wins. But, you know, we need that model was replaced by, in the boom years for newspapers, you know, public ownership, stock sales. Now we're looking for whatever the next thing is. Is it going to be nonprofit? Is it going to be, you know, rich, you know, the LA Times was just sold to a very rich investor in LA. You know, we don't know what that's going to be. The one thing that I'm hopeful for is seeing places that are like startup nonprofit newsrooms who don't have the baggage of like, okay, we have to print all the high school sports scores and we have to print, you know, Mary Worth and Marmaduke and we have to run this, you know, places that just do the parts of journalism that are public service and people are interested in and they don't inherit the baggage of a daily newspaper. So I'm from Texas. There's a Texas Tribune is a wonderful example of that. It's a nonprofit. It's members, but it also has readers and it does events. It does a lot of convening of people in Texas all over the state to make people feel like they're, you know, if you're a part of being an educated, informed, interested Texan, this is, you know, you do it through Texas Tribune. That's part of your identity. I think NPR is ahead of the newspaper business in that way. But I hope people can cultivate that and monetize it as a source of strength in the future.
Just in a couple of minutes we have left with our conversation here, what would you say to news consumers that they should be looking for in, as a writer and a reporter, what should they be looking for in a good quality piece on politics?
Well, I mean, I think that what you have to do now is learn is is pay attention to sources. And I don't just mean the Washington Post versus, like, you know, number one USA Patriot News or whatever was written by somebody in Bulgaria that says the Pope just arrested Hillary Clinton or something. But also to pay attention to writers you like and to use the tools of social media to follow people that you trust and, you know, follow sources you trust. And to be conscious, and I've tried to be conscious, if somebody breaks your trust, meaning they get something wrong, or you read something by them that predicts something that doesn't come true, if they seem like some sort of, you know, pundit that actually is opining on things they know nothing about, get that out of your diet. You know, reward what you find accurate. You know, to pay attention to sources and find ways of rewarding them, not just with your attention but with your money. But I think that so many people want to spend time reading things that reinforce your existing political views, or maybe even worse, just reading Twitter, you know, sort of scrolling through a million headlines in a day and not actually diving into any of them. I've tried to be really conscious about being the kind of reader that I want to read my stories. So reading the stories I find interesting and remembering and rewarding the outlets that I like.
David Farenthold, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Broadcast Journalist Series conversation with Washington Post politics reporter David Farenthold, the winner of the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. I'm Mike Edgerling.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerry at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.